So welcome to the Jerome Stern Distinguished Writers Series. Tonight we're going to hear readings from Laura Roque and Eleanor Mary Boudreau.
But before we start that, there are a few reminders. Please don't smoke. Please turn off your cell phones and all other noise-making devices. And please try not to get up in the middle of the reading. We will have a break in between. And please join me in welcoming our first introducer, Sakina Hoffler.
There are two Laura Roques. Not a two-faced Laura Roque, more like the multiple personalities all of us have to inhibit in order to survive being around different groups of people. There's a Laura Roque that everyone thinks they know. The cheesy grin Laura, the can't stay still Laura, the I've got the hookup Laura, the party hard Laura that can't stop going home to Hialeah or visiting friends in Gainesville, the Instagram Laura who writes quotes such as, El uniforme. I probably wear shorts, Jordans, and a crop top to my wedding. Or, went fishing for piranhas in an Amazon, the little bastard was delicious. Or, missing these skanks, hashtag trashy trio, hashtag tatas, hashtag Hialeah 305. Then there's the Laura that, if you're lucky, and if she deems you worthy enough, you'll get a chance to meet. That's a private Laura. I'm not gonna reveal all of her secrets, but I'll let you know a few. First, she's fiercely loyal. Katie, her hashtag ride or die, I hope you get a chance to hear this recording. If any of you out there ever mess with her BFF Katie, Laura won't just threaten to cut you. She'll slice you to pieces. Laura is not afraid of jail. Second, Laura is one of the hardest working people that I know. Yes, she's a borderline genius, and I'm not just saying that because she has a high IQ, she does. But she also has this inane, insane ability to get work done despite the craziness in her life. If you ever heard Laura talk about her freshman year at UF, you know how inadequately her high school prepared her for college, and how she had to work her beautiful ass off to keep up with her classmates. So yes, you'll see Laura posting on Instagram, on Snapchat, and Facebook. But she doesn't post the other half of her life, where she's in a library with 30 poetry books, prepping for her poetry portfolio, or reading Faulkner over and over again, or spending hours at her desk in Williams, finessing, refining, and perfecting her work. I personally believe Laura works double the amount of time that she parties and that she simply does not sleep. Third, when you look at Laura, appreciate the fact that she's here. Often in this program, we speak of privilege. And I often think one of the main privileges many of us overlook is the fact that we're here doing what we love. Many of us come from economically stable backgrounds. Many of us had guidance counselors in high school that worked with us on college applications. Laura didn't have any of that. She grew up in a crazy neighborhood. She went to a high school filled with violence, knife fights, teachers who did not care, guidance counselors who did not care, no one who cared if she went to school or not, a high school where most of the students didn't graduate, and the ones that did didn't see college as an option. She wound up applying to school only because she was actually lost and a little bit wasted and mistakenly walked into a college fair. But she won't tell you that. She won't complain. She just keeps it moving, keeps working, and tries to better herself every day. Bob Shakosha's call her a survivor. I'm gonna call her a hustler. Future Nobel winner Sean Carter, AKA Jay-Z, wrote in his song, in my slightly altered version of the Hard Knock Life, she don't know how to sleep, she gotta eat, stay on her toes, got a lot of beef, so logically she preys on her foes. Hustling still inside of her, and as far as progress goes, you'd be hard-pressed to find another writer as hot as her. I'm giving y'all a prophecy. Lastly, don't you ever forget this, the actual correct pronunciation of her name is Laura. Laura Roque is the daughter of two Cuban political exiles and was raised in Hialeah, Florida. She graduated from the University of Florida in 2014 and is currently killing her third year as an MFA student at FSU. Please join me in welcoming Miss Laura Roque to the stage.
Sakina, that was so awesome. Thank you. Okay, how do I? I wore heels and everything to avoid this one. Okay. Okay, thank you, Sakina. That was so awesome. And thank you to our host. You guys do such a good job every week. And thank you to everyone for coming. Okay, so tonight I'm going to read an excerpt of a story because I'm incapable of actually writing a short story. So, yeah, so I'm just going to give you guys a little bit of background in the beginning and then I'll jump into it. So the story opens up with a protagonist. She's 15. She has two boyfriends at once who she, you know, uses and abuses. And so she moves on to another person she mistreats for a guy for 2 years. And what I'm about to pick up, like, right after that's over. So this is the middle of Don't Wear Shoes You Can't Jump a Fence In. Surrounded by set destinies, fourth grade reading levels, and pregnant bellies, you know nothing but Hialeah and what inevitably becomes of those who stay, which is everyone. You're just another episode of this season's self-fulfilling prophecy, en route to getting wifed up by some chico, moving to his parents' house or having him move in with you and mommy, although some section of the house will eventually be closed off and you have your very own efficiency. Sure, you'll go to college or high school the sequel at Miami-Dade because tu papá y yo sacrificed everything to come to this country and you can't not have something resembling a degree. You'll pop out kids that'll grow up to be just like you, and as the years stack and the tits that never showed up to the party droop, you'll sit languorously at some office job you're not good or bad at. One you'll swipe like cake because you can actually speak English. And yet, you're good at some things. The English teachers keep trying to inculcate that fact into your creative brain. It's almost hopeless. You should really stop doing so much ecstasy. Senior year, you wander into a college fair, high and lost, and an advisor tells you about the University of Florida. You can't afford to visit any of the colleges, and you don't have the time because you work, but it's ranking as alluring, and you like the pictures you look up in computer class. Homegirl's parents both went there, and the two of you start conjuring college plans you know are mad and unrealistic. Your SAT scores are straight, but nothing remarkable, just under UF's average, because you and homegirl were raging on SOBI the night before and were hungover for the test. But your GPA is fuego because your school's a joke, and for the essay you whip out the big guns, the dead daddy poor girl from Hialeah story. The same day you submit your application, your homegirl comes over with Hector, the only other degenerate that can tolerate your guys' whirlwind. You paint each other the school colors, with homegirl and you in size zero jean shorts and sports bras, Hector shirtless and in basketball shorts, and handprints on everyone's tits, and you head to the last football game of the year, chugging Skull Vodka and homegirl's car on the way. You finally have some priorities, bro. You are ready to escape this vortex of croquetas and tricked out Honda Civics. You're damn excited about possibilities, or maybe just cheaper liquor. Whatever the case, you've seen the freaking light. Your future has been radiated. The future actually exists. You sigh happily, watching everything with longing and envisioning yourself missing it when he punctures your blurry purview at halftime. No smile, square jaw, arms swinging like he's on his way to whoop someone's ass. He's in some fitted jeans, impeccable nalgas on display, and a black t-shirt with a tacky skull emblem his mom probably bought at Valsang. Immediately, you reason that if you don't fuck that guy, you will die. That's Tom, Hector says in between vodka and grape juice swigs, clutching the crinkled water bottle like a mic. Who? You play dumb. No way you've been caught drooling a swimming pool over some dude. You have forfeited this part of your life anyway, the life that is moving forward, the life that will now be interrupted by dick. The guy you're staring at, he wrestled with me, Hector says. You take the vodka from him and chug. Introduce me, you hear yourself say. Hell no, Hector says. Years after that, post the arrest, the bruises, the globs of saliva spat into faces, the physical and emotional whatever, you'll have an eerie dream about that exact moment and dream you, smarter you, will elect to go about your day with friends and not meet the person you'll love and despise most. You'll wake up knowing of the dream's impossibility because your behavior was wholly out of your hands and that as much as you hurt each other, you wouldn't take it back. Maybe because of your love affair with turmoil, everyone's a masochist, and that addiction to male attention, but mostly because those first few months you spent with him were like taking deep breaths on the highest peak of a mountain, altitude sickness included. I tried to save you, Hector will say over drinks, 5 years after the football game, when you're back in town. He's also never left Hialeah. The pangong bistes, pollo empanizados, and rice so greasy it signals from space will have caught up with him, and you have a newfound gut spilling over the table, but the same job at Verizon. I know, you'll say, raise your glass, toasting to his good intentions. As Tom approaches you, it feels as though someone's tickling the backs of your knees while trying to give you CPR, when you were breathing just fine. It reminds you of stalking El Musico, but as infatuated as you were then, you were slick, could muster smart little sentences. But when Tom stands before you on the footing of the bleachers, with you on the seat so your eyes are level, you don't know words. Tomas, this is Leida, Leila, this is Tomas, Hector says. Hi, Tom says, holding out his hand. It takes a whack from homegirl watching next to Hector to react. Leila, you hear yourself say. Grateful that your name is two syllables because you're suddenly in special ed. Nice to meet you, he says. Aplomb is all hell. You're Hector's friend, right? Comes from your mouth. He looks at Hector like you're broken, then back at you. Yeah, he says, smiling. You're cute, you say, overwhelmed by all the pulchritude. Slap him on the chest. What the fuck? At the end of the game, you sprint up to him, obliterated. Your body aches from being banged against aluminum because when Tom returned to his friends, post your unforgettable first encounter, it started to rain, enabling Hector and you to slide down an entire flight of bleachers, cackling like hyenas beneath the disappointed eyes of administrators and other students. You're bad. None of us can drive. Can you drive my girl's car back? You ask Tom, concentrating on the bridge of his nose. He studies you in a way that looks like he's conjuring a list in his head, and you know he's heard about you. Later, you'll find out that he was actually at a few parties with you, playing beer pong or starting fights in the living room as you entertained upstairs. He bites his large lips so the lower one disappears. Then he looks at his beckoning friends, warning him with bulging eyeballs or subtly shaking their heads. Hey, I'll catch up with you guys later, he says to them, and you take deep breaths to keep from leaping or dancing. Tom drives you and your drunk friends around that night, even as Hector sees his ex in her new boo and punches a tow-away sign, and his hand morphs into a boxing glove. The five of you end up on a roof of a shopping center, a place you usually loitered. Your friends are acting a fool in one corner, with Hector singing to his hand, the plastic bag of ice you got on a Taco Bell plopped over, another water bottle of vodka in the crook of his elbow, and homegirl trying to snatch it from him without hurting his hand. Keen on avoiding underage kid with alcohol poisoning, episode 3. You walk off to the edge of the building, not stopping until the tops of your chucks are suspended in midair, praying that Tom will follow. Please, don't fall, he says too appropriately, standing beside you. I've done this before, you say and shrug. To keep from ogling, your eyes go to the buzzing specks swarming a light post like a beehive. What are you looking at? He asks. You point to the insects, idiotically committing suicide on the light bulb. This is when you find out that he isn't a dumb jock, that he only listens to classic rock because all other genres are senseless, and he's obsessed with Dawkins and Darwin, wants to be an evolutionary biologist, still idolizes his childhood hero, Indiana Jones, that his favorite book is Wuthering Heights, and that he's fucking read Wuthering Heights. You make your desire to sleep with him evident enough, and when everyone is ready to ride, he insists on dropping off Hector, picking up his own car, driving behind your homegirl to make sure she gets home all right, and before taking you home. The paint you smear all over the seats of his Lancer will stay there forever, because you accidentally bought acrylic instead of body paint. And sometimes you'll look to it, try to remember why it was there in the first place, because he just spat gum at his face for calling you a slut, and he just shoved you out of his car, and now you're missing chunks of skin from your thighs and arms that have been colored in by gravel. Because you forfeited those parts of you he deems dirty and unacceptable, because now you think they are too. Because you would and will forfeit everything for his existence, including your own, almost. But even as you change, mold and shove yourself within the boundaries defined by his machista ideals, by the rules of your own tios and primos, maybe the father you never got to know, the rules that state what a woman must be, there's a part of you that won't budge, because it can't. Because even when it's been in your best interest to change, you are undeniably yourself. Maybe it's because you were raised by a woman with mad cojones, who works her ass off in a country that doesn't want her, but is still quiet and afraid of everything because some psycho murdered her husband, which makes you want to punch everything in the face. Maybe you just don't like being told what to do. Or maybe you really do love to get fucked up more than anything and would risk a relationship for a night out. Either way, you fight back and don't run away when you should. The day after you meet Tom is Halloween. The same crew reunites and you roam the town only to end up back on the roof with more vodka and love-struck palpitations. Your homegirl gets too drunk and passes out on the floor. And so when the night comes to a close, she has to be carried to the car. The movement in the elevator disturbs her, and by the time you all reach the first floor, she's full-on flipping a shit in Hector's arms, every limb flailing, screaming, I'm gonna puke, and you for sure damn believe her. The doors part, and Hector lurches forward, because getting her up in the first place had been an hour ordeal, and he wasn't about to go through it again. Also yelling, due to the fingernails she's dug into his arms when her weepy supplications to be put down were a no-go. Tom leaves your side for the first time all night, sprinting ahead to unlock the Lancer. Upon arrival, homegirl plants her palms on the body of the car, arms as unyielding as tree trunks, keeping Hector from placing her inside. Then, slipping from his grasp, she lays face down on the pavement, mumbling, 5 minutes. Shit, you say, patting yourself, my stuff. You'd forgotten your purse on the roof, distracted by homegirl, sans consciousness. I'll go with you, Tom says. Watch her, you say to Hector, and he nods, lights a stogie. You and Tom take the elevator, which goes to the third floor and a pathway to the roof of the second floor. When the door is shut, he stands an inch from you, still in the jujitsu gi he used to dress as a ninja, the flaps hanging open, loosened by the passing hours and the night's comemiederia, exposing scattered patches of chest hair that deter your brain function. He'd also accessorized with a samurai sword, but left it in the car. He tucks a finger into your fishnets, the invasive knuckle injecting a heat wave you feel emitting from your cheeks. You're a pinup girl for the fourth year in a row. Tom kisses you, and you feel like your core is being stung by a pledge of wasps, like you're upside down in pitch darkness. When you pull apart, the elevator opens on the first floor, and you have no idea if it even moved. That future you'd envisioned, that light you'd seen just yesterday, not wholly, but practically extinguished. Dim till further noticed, in un abrir y cerrar of an elevator. You count down the seconds until school is over, all the while cavorting the hall so giddy it's embarrassing, because he's always waiting for you outside. He doesn't approve of shirts that show your stomach or shorts that are too short, because you should respect him and yourself more than that. He forgoes all of his plans, his entire life before you, and thinks you should do the same, thinks your friends are pieces of shit, and he distances you from them, for your own good. He's the sexiest thing you've ever seen in your life, just the way he walks soaks your panties, and you can't help the disbelief splatter on your face when he says you're the most beautiful thing he's ever seen. You don't want to be anywhere without him, but you're not allowed to be either. He says he doesn't just love you for who you are, but what you can be. He doesn't just see you as some deranged crackhead despite everything he's heard. He sees potential. He talks down to you, but maybe it isn't on purpose, because he's the most intelligent person you know, and sometimes you can be an idiot. He picks you up at 1 a.m. every night when mommy is well into sleeping pill delirium, and the two of you drive around aimlessly, Guns N' Roses CDs on repeat, his terrible singing voice clawing at each note like a dog scrambling up some stairs. You elect random highways and exits, trying to get as lost together as you can on purpose. For some reason, you always end up accidentally homebound. You've always suffered from insomnia, a condition that stemmed from waking up every night to mommy crying in the kitchen. And when you doze off in Tom's car, he drives around, sometimes for hours, until you wake up on your own. You watch meteor showers, him lying on the grass, his entire back sloshed with dew, you on top of him, wholly dry, or chase gaps in the clouds around Miami when it's overcast, eager for a smidge of stars. You talk about the universe, how insignificant you are in the grand scheme, and how logically significant you are to each other. You discuss his sister in Cuba, mommy down the street. Most of the late nights you spend together involve trespassing, because all you and Tom need is a car to sit on, need something to sit on, but aren't about sitting in the same car every night tampoco. Sometimes you have time to dip, having seen the red and blue lights lurking. Other times you wait, a daring refusal to move until the piggy's voice spits into the speaker. The first time a cop car rolled up, you and Tom darted like flechas in opposite directions, leapt the fence, and found each other blocks away. Being the chancletera that you are, you scratched up your feet pretty bad on the fence. But bloody notches y todo, you still ran because, like Tom says, pain is only as bad as you acknowledge it. You never know what situation your little ass will be put in, he said, moving one of the arms, cupping your thunder thighs and a piggyback to squeeze a cheek, the corpse of your flip-flops somewhere by the fence. You quit swinging your bare feet, waiting for him to secure his grasp again, analyzing the dripping cuts that gave off the impression that you stepped into a box of menopausal cats. Better to be equipped, he said. Convinced that everything wants to sleep with you, he attacks every dude that looks your way. The fighting turns you on at first, naively interpreting it as him defending your honor or some shit, until one night when he buries a car key into a man's neck, leaving him clutching a seeping wound on the floor of an alleyway in East Hialeah. He tries to have sex with you that night, but you can't get wet. All you can think about are bloody forearms. You don't believe in love at first sight, but you can't remember not loving him. Mommy's scared for you, but you lie about not wanting to wear shorts anymore, cover the handprints, and she can't do anything about it. Usted tiene una relación enfermiza, she says. Ese niño no está bien de la cabeza. And by then you know, it dawned on you from week two. You know that he gets off on dehumanizing people, and that he feels zero remorse for the pain in people's eyes when he's angry, fights his own friends, his father, probably because he was smaller and bullied as a child, but he'll never admit this. He behaves like a sociopath, but you believe that passion like yours is worth keeping whatever the cost. Perhaps a byproduct of adolescence, but no one will ever exasperate you like Tom. All right, so I'm going to summarize this part really fast. So she gets into UF, and Tom resents her for it, and he breaks up with her every weekend, so she goes home instead of actually developing a life at UF, right? And then a year after that, he gets into the same school. And it's a really emotional moment because he realizes that she's inspired him to be something more than what was written for him. So when the second year rolls around, they move in together. And you, after a year of his, I know you couldn't turn a whore into a housewife. and you're sticking him in the face and him choking you out until you're unconscious, move in with him because he'd kill someone for you. Later, you realize he'd even kill you for you. Like new things do, moving in together solves your problems for a while. It's still summertime, and all the friends you met your first year, all the people you partied with after you kissed him goodnight on the phone with a pseudo-groggy voice, stilettos on, painting your nails, are still away, and you feel guilty about lying to him, although he's never felt guilty about putting you in a cage. You cook for the both of you, because you can't eat pasta every night. You do all the laundry, scrubbing his skid marks and all, because he doesn't know how to wash clothes or wipe his ass, as a Cuban man never should. You work 30 hours a week at a gas station Subway, always graveyard shift because you've enrolled in 16 credits, because you want to graduate with him, because you've made plans to go to grad school together. The neighbors call the cops at least once a month, and the cops swallow the bitter taste in their mouths and accept the same statement, eyeing the holes in the wall, the cracked television screen. Your homegirl doesn't call anymore. She won't sit there and watch you get killed, she says. Granted, you've become a shit girlfriend, although according to him, claro que you've always been one. Some weekends, you start fights on purpose, which is about as easy as Tom says you were in high school, and pack up for the weekend and stay at a friend's. You spend these nights exchanging body shots, dancing on tables, ignoring all of his calls. He finds you sometimes, dragging you out by whatever he can grab. Sometimes he doesn't. How was all that dick you got this weekend? He asks when you get home Monday morning. You throw your duffel, bulky with puta clothes and heels, on the floor, and go to the kitchen for some water, swaying, still faded. I'm talking to you, he snarls. A toddler revving up for a tantrum. You know I didn't fuck anyone, you say truthfully, because Thomas sucked you free of the deception that was once almost natural. You're disgusting, he says, already in your face. I wanted one weekend without surveillance. Then get the fuck out, he yells, neck veins bulging, light from the window illuminating the drops of spit he sends flying. I pay rent too, you piece of shit. You move away from him and walk towards the table. Don't fucking talk to me like that. He reaches over, squeezes your arm. I'm just returning what I'm getting, you say, snatching it away. You're getting what someone like you deserves, he says. You slap him across the face, the smack echoing in the studio apartment like a plate clanging to the floor. The same apartment you sleep in so soundly sometimes, wrapped in his limbs, beneath a rattling ceiling fan, missing a panel and a half. He plants a hand on your face and slams you down. You're too close to the table, and the corner almost takes out your eye. You'll have a hairless sliver on your eyebrow forever. One of many marks on your body that'll remain long after he's peaced out. And you'll stare at them, unsure of whether you should be proud or ashamed. You're about to swing, but the red coating half of your face makes you both stop. All the aspirin you take for your migraines has thinned out your blood. Mommy freaked out when she realized how much you were taking, said it was why Papa bled out instantly when he was shot that night. Tom dabs a paper towel soaked in hydrogen peroxide onto your flinching face, a band-aid on his lap, your eyes on his perfect lips, a face you want to kiss and pulverize, eyes you want to claw out and stare at forever. He touches your chin with his free hand, turning your face. I'm sorry, he says. I love you, you say. Some fights lead to you fucking right there on the carpet he threw you on, your grip still around his neck from when you tried strangling him. Yes, he's probably more than twice as strong as you and causes significant damage, but you hit back. You don't shut the hell up when he's already made you dizzy with a smack, and you always, always, always come back. It's the end of your second year. You're washing your face in the morning and realize you hate yourself and your life. It's taken 2 years to sort out your feelings of love and hate, realize you feel both of them, realize they can't coexist, and that love ain't shit. You're only 20. At work, you call a friend you met at a party you snuck off to, remembering that his roommate is moving back to Jersey and they're in search of a replacement. He agrees to come by on Sunday with his truck to pick up your things. Tom is leaving home to visit his family, reassured by the hectic work schedule you've claimed to have, and instead you've asked off so you can pack what's left of your life into boxes. Tom returns to a vacant house. You've taken the bed, which was yours, and the dresser, also yours, and left him with an old futon and walls with so many holes, it's like you were living in cheese. Where the fuck are you, he texts. But he knows, probably from some messages he's encountered. You've told him before he should just quit that anthropology shit and go into hacking full time. He shows up, pounds on the door, but eventually lets you be, excluding daily lies about suicide attempts and girls in his bed to get you back. By then, you're smoking too much weed to have cohesive thoughts and working nonstop. And 2 months after that, you're back home for the summer, back in good terms with homegirl without deserving it. You fall into your old habits with men, partying with low-life chicos who sell drugs from their abuela's house, who drive the freshest whips but don't play child support because fuck that bitch. They don't care about what you felt, what you've accomplished, if you're capable of accomplishing anything. Maybe they shouldn't, because maybe Tom is right about you. When your third year of college begins, when you and Tom get back together, things are fantastic for a few days because you've lied to him about all your indiscretions. You attempt to start over from separate houses. A month in, he hacks your email, then your Facebook, gets caught up on your pulpería. In a panic, because things were reminiscent of the beginning, you beg for forgiveness because he was right about you and you missed him every day because he's confiscated parts of you. It'll take you years to realize they were all parts you liked. But as you lay on your knees, the carpet biting your skin like fleas, you don't know who you are anymore. A victim of abuse, a silly liar who deserves it, someone defending themselves, or someone starting a fight. Then he's fixing your leaky sink, and you're watching him work. He's always trying to fix something. Last week, he messed up the stove when it wasn't completely broken to begin with. Now none of the burners work. Remember the day we met, you ask? How can I forget it? His voice sounds far away from inside the cabinets. You know I knew then, you say, and he leans back, sitting on his heels. You can still remember, we'll always remember, just what you were thinking when he distracted you from the football game and everything else. Knew what exactly? He turns to face you. That I wanted you, and this, you say? You were drunk, he says. I had to have you. You have me, he says. Thank you.
And here to introduce our second reader is Tanya Gray. Please welcome her.
With a well-worn copy of Plato's Dialogues hardwired in her brain, Eleanor Mary Boudreau is an investigative philosopher. 30-minute coffee can easily become a 3-hour conversation, a great one. Hers is a poetry of unvarnished observation, which both meditates on and celebrates the chaotic nature of life. Through a leaping reportage, we are sitting in the middle of the date gone wrong, listening to the play-by-play, and somehow watching from the audience. Triangulating, she surprises us with cinematic leaps, mapping points in a shifting landscape, and drawing lines between them. She triangulates to find oneself in the singularity of a moment. Eleanor's past lives include a horseback riding instructor, canvasser, and a dry cleaner. More recently, she spent 4 years working as a radio reporter for the NPR member station in Memphis. A graduate of Harvard holding an MFA from Houston, she is now a PhD student in poetry at Florida State. Her poetry has been published or is forthcoming in New American Writing, The Denver Quarterly, Diagram, and Copper Nickel. Please welcome Eleanor Mary Boudreau.
So, Laura, that was awesome. It's a real honor for me to read with you. It was awesome and excruciating, but in an awesome way. And thank you, everyone, for being here. Of course, it's a real honor for me to be here. So the first poem I'm going to read is probably the most fragmentary of the night, so buckle up. It's called 1,000 Words on Regret. From the pond behind the barn, the talented dogs pull frog after frog. Eleanor, a dog picked up one of Rachel's gloves. Let me know if you see it. It's white and beige, and it's not hers. It's not a dog toy. It's not a dog toy. I found a glove, but it's not Rachel's. I start the engine in my car, and the little needles jump up to me in greetings. Terribly, terribly small. Greetings, they say. Greetings. And Lucy, Chris's dog, slides through the dried leaves on the hillside. The cast on her left hind, inflexible as metal, is covered with green bones. I have something to say to you, but I refrain from saying it. I feel terribly, terribly small. Down, doggy, down. Last night, I had sex for as long as it takes to drive to the gas station on Cambridge Street. And all the silver sperm capsized in the jelly. Imagine their surprise. Like beached fish, give me 1,000 words on regretfulness. Sitting in the grass, I'm trying to write out, I hate you. I have, I gave, I gate. And it's just too difficult to do. I gate you. My jaw hurts, and so I say it out loud. My jaw hurts, and that just makes it hurt worse. Swallow a candy in panic, and it just sits in your stomach. Please, there is room. Make use of the furniture. The title on your bookshelf, Whores on the Hillside, and I say, whales are mammals, and abortions don't take place in your stomach. A trailing, smoky breath primed for the coming extinction. I know that I'm not stupid. In their paddock, the horses roar like dinosaurs. Bully for me, that's the creative spirit. The sunlight on the roof, stone banisters missing. A pair of tan/gold fishnets, tights, help. The whole world is turning into words, and I don't believe them. Okay, this next one it's one of the shortest poems I've ever written and the prissiest. It would be an Italian sonnet, rhymes and everything, except it's 15 lines. So this is Sonnet Boston Proper. In Providence, my boss said hesitation kills. Was true then, is true now. The radio replayed. We want a lady in the street, a freak in bed. The spaces in between, I don't know how to fill. 3 times I've ridden in a horse-drawn carriage like a character from Austin's Pride and Prejudice, as towers built by Puritans' offspring, tactless, cast phallic shadows over cobble streets, oblique junctions, chevrons of stone, outdone but not outclassed. The first you asked why I loved you. I did not know. I did not know what I should say. This is my fate. The horse hooves kissed the street. One horse, one of a pair, broke to canter, a 3-beat, not a 2-beat gait, and each beat registered on your face like a blow. The steel beams rigid, towers elastic, in air. And this is Wedding Planning. Thank you. This is Wedding Planning. I begin to dread the surf and turf. I cross, then double cross, another friend off of the list. Now this. The jaws of leopard seals and grizzly bears are similar, except the leopard seals are twice as big. They're also more intelligent. God knows my mother likes to tell me things I do not want to know in restaurants. This scientist, she studied icebergs in Antarctica. She watched them drift and scour the seafloor and the ensuing loss of life and habitat. This story I know cold and could deglove. Snow settled round the research base like a halo. The ancient face, the surface of the bay. Under a layer of jostling, floating crags, brash ice. Birds flew in fists into the teeth of sky. Whether she believed in God or anything below us, wind furred the shallows and she snorkeled out. The leopard seal attacked from underneath, and so she must have seen the open jaws, the teeth. She screamed, was dragged, her dive computer says, to a depth of 230 feet.
Just as revenge, a dish is best served cold, I cross another friend off of my list. A punishment should be immediate, but accident cannot be reckoned with. This is the myth inside decorum. And what I've ordered never does arrive. So after wedding planning, this is about as narrative as I get. We get, you marry a man. You marry a man and you think his blood is red. Turns out it's not, it's purple. And it doesn't matter, it's not why you married him, but you did. You thought his blood was red. And he has never read Shakespeare, knows nothing of the quality of mercy. But he reminds you every day that you're not Shakespeare. You know you're not Shakespeare, Eleanor, he says. He says this to you as you peel and eat a doleful, dull banana. And that's fine, too. When you habitate with someone, he's saying now that habitate is not a word in the dictionary. And maybe not in the dictionary, but I heard it on a nature program. Who died and made you police of the English language? You have to put up with a few statements of the obvious. Example, what are you doing? Obvious. What do you think you are doing should be obviously inferable. What are you reading? This is what they make book covers for. But it could be worse. He could be saying things that are untrue. He could be saying things that are wrong. I invite you, my darling, to consider the difference between untrue and wrong. I feel you often avoid saying things that are not true by stating the obvious. I feel you often say things that are wrong. And then there are the things there are two ways of looking at. The banana on the counter. With its ends pointed up, it looks happy. Looks, in fact, like a smile. But with its ends pointed down, it looks doleful again. Or maybe it's just that we both have different definitions. I thought I do was fairly self-explanatory. You didn't. We both have very different definitions of pain. What I think hurts and what you think hurts me are very different. And it's not just the things you think, but the things you don't think that hurt me as well. I bleed. Don't you see? This is not about whose blood is redder. You're an alien. And I forgive you, even that. But I bleed. The point is, I bleed. And then he says, I have the dictionary on my lap. You don't own the dictionary, baby. We both own it. The speech that ends all conversation. There is nothing to be said to heal this. I have the dictionary in my lap. Look at the words betraying their meanings. Betray as in desert in time of need. Look at the words betraying their meanings. Betray as in reveal. Look at the words. All right, this next one is called Calm Down. The sun bouncing on the floor of the horizon, and still I feel this, the first ounce of haughtiness I have ever felt, collecting behind my jaw, help. He is turning into a lizard, sunning himself by the pool. He sticks a Dorito in his mouth, and it makes a crunching sound. The bag, a net of light, increases, shines and crinkles.
He broke my nose. When I say that I am being tortured, why is this not funny? When I say I've been tortured, he tortured me. Clearly, I don't mean it. Why is this not funny? I'm sad. And sadness only breeds more sadness, like sandwiches cut into pieces, cut into triangular pieces. And he says, I don't care if you finish your sandwich, but I don't want to have to look at it anymore. I should not still be talking. My mouth, my mangled sandwich, my lips moving like the seam they aren't. My tongue, a hot needle that sews nothing. Shut, my mouth should not be talking. Calm down, Eleanor. The sun going down on the tropics, the sun light descending on the sweaty tropics, the sun trying to look demure. His hand came crashing down on me and broke. Damned for a moment, the wave, the stream of light, and my nose was broken. Look, more demureness. The pool is only a carpet of water threaded with waves of light. The red triangles make a crunching sound. I tell the joke until it is funny. The punchline is, you bitch, you've ruined my life. I looked through the utensils for a long time before I settled on the spoon. What would I need a knife for? I'm not angry. My nose is still broken. The frailty of woman, this table is perfectly clear, but the carpet, viewed through it, looks darker. I tread over the spilled rice grains on the carpet, and my heart sinks a little further, a thread into the carpet. Oh no. He is turning into a lizard again, in his terrarium, only sorrow. The soda bottles in their racks, the soda bottles, waves of white caps. Okay, so I have two more. This second to last is the longer of the two, but it's not quite that long. It's called The Heart is Not a Synonym for the Chest. What you called a cloud was not a cloud. I'm in hell here. Hell is a party where I don't sing and I don't dance, and someone turns to me and says, you are a very pretty girl. Don't ever forget that. I spend all night tramping up and down the staircase trying to figure out if you really love me. Each stair is a copy of the first, and each of your words is a copy of the one before it. Love, love, love. Above us, an 18-wheeler on the highway bucks and shifts, fishtailing. And you think of me. I would think of you too, bucking and shifting, but that is not my heart. That is not my heart. That's my left breast. There is a photocopier at the top of the staircase. I make a photocopy of my heart for you. It says, WTF. I am in hell here, and I have picked up some of the language. If I was Eurydice, I would not be mad at Orpheus. I'd be the register above. The truck, our house, our life together, these things I do not miss. A reminder written out on every mirror. You are a very attractive lady. Don't ever forget. This I do not miss. The bathroom with its three mirrors, I am happy. Humming to myself in the morning when you enter. You would be here behind me again and lay your hand over my left hip like a shadow. This I do not miss. The bathroom beginning to look like a lobster trap with its yellow bars of reflected light, and my skin turning pink with sex again. This I miss. The knowledge that there is blood and it is pounding. Fishy rivers beneath the skin. Okay, so to close, I'm going to read a short excerpt, like minute and a half from a longer work. But because it's longer work, I just feel like I have to say a few things. The first is that I've been thinking a lot about a particular piece of Puritan theology known as predestination. I'm not a Puritan. I just promise, like, this stuff, it's in the water in Massachusetts, which is where I grew up. So the idea is that when you're born, you're either part of the elect and you're going to heaven, or you're part of the damned and you're going to hell. And there's really nothing you can do about it. It's just, you know, it's decided. God decides. But the incentive to behave well is kind of like, you know, you're part of the elect and you want your neighbors to think you're part of the elect, and the elect behave like the elect. So you just behave like a member of the elect. So that's predestination. That's the piece I've been thinking about. It's kind of the Jay-Z line, like, man, you was who you was before you got here. Like, that's predestination. And the other thing you need to know about this short excerpt, it's called The Rhyme of the Naive Adulteress. And basically, there's the adulteress cheating on her husband. She's taking a road trip with her lover, not her husband. He's driving. She's the passenger. So he's the driver. She's the passenger. And yeah, that's what this is from. The Puritans got a bad rep for being humorless, the driver said on a car trip. But they had some good ideas. Life is like Terminator 2, Judgment Day. Like this trip, prescripted as to be or not. The question is bullshit. You can't be whatever you want or do whatever you want. You can't even say what you want. Not without consequence. The passenger looked out the window, the pain of which reminds, in her dreams as a child, transparent dragons were circling always, animating the landscape with their transparent scales. And she was terrified. She always wanted to cry out, fire, fire, fire! A moment too soon. The only time she could do anyone any good. Our heroine yelling fire, fire indeed. What naive and childish pluck, when ultimately it comes down to a simple game of luck. Tails, you're saved, but heads, you burn. Thank you.